2 weeks ago, we began a series on the structure of the Gospel of John. And I had originally, when I first had this in my mind, thought that I was going to cover all of this material in one night. But as I began to type it up, I realized I was hopelessly deceived in the amount of time this was going to take to cover. And then as I began to actually speak it, I realized I was more deceived than I had thought. This was going to take a little bit longer. So we may finish up next week. It may be another week after that. But anyways, let's see. I already said what I was going to say about that, so I'm going to try to be brief in the review, but we need to have at least a little bit of review. So we began by discussing the dilemma that many of us feel, both because of our current cultural climate and because of our own personal limitations. We often feel as though the only way we could make an impact in our world is to go out and do something great for God. Much of the time, our paradigm for significance, what we think of, what would be something great that I could do for God, it resembles the ministry of Peter, who saw thousands converted through his preaching on the day of Pentecost, and we elaborated on that a bit more the first week. Yet what we must remember is that although Peter certainly made an impact, he was not the only one who did. As the structure of the Gospel of John reveals, there is more than one paradigm for faithful discipleship. And we'll return to this at the end of the series. And the gospel, the structure of the Gospel of John reveals something about that that I think when we finally do get to it will be profoundly encouraging. We then discussed some of the things that set the Gospel of John apart from the three synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. John has a very different structure from the synoptic Gospels. And if I have time this summer or perhaps at some other time, perhaps I'll spend a week or two on the structure of the Synoptic Gospels, which is also very interesting. John has less than half as many miracle accounts as the shortest of the Synoptic Gospels. It has none of the story parables that are so characteristic of the Synoptics, particularly of the Gospel of Luke, and Lord willing, I'll be covering one of those on Sunday morning. It has very few of the pithy, aphoristic, proverb-like sayings that are so common in the Synoptics, particularly in Matthew. John is, as we discussed last week, intensely selective. Importantly, one thing that John does is to take language that's only used one or two times in the Synoptic Gospels, match it up one time with the language that is more commonly used in the Synoptics, and then use it almost exclusively throughout his Gospel. This is perhaps most notable with his use of life language rather than kingdom language. So the Synoptic Gospels talk a lot about entering into the kingdom of God. John talks about entering into life. The tie-in is in the story of Nicodemus, where John uses both. And there's more detail, we talked about that. But we're going to see another example of that tonight. Though John, like the Synoptics, sometimes quotes the Old Testament scripture directly, and we'll see one of those places tonight, his primary interaction with the Old Testament comes in the form of a densely woven thicket of allusions. John is an intensely allusive document to the Old Testament. Of course, there's more, both more that we covered previously and more we didn't cover previously, but this is enough to get us started. The next thing we did was to lay out an overall structure for the Gospel of John, covering along the way some of the differences between modern and ancient ways of structuring texts. Our goal, of course, is to get at the structure that is in the text, not simply to come up with a structure we can impose on the text. And one of the primary structuring techniques in the ancient world, a technique we still use today, though of course now we have many others, was the practice of recapitulation, also known as framing or inclusio. This particular technique was used extensively for John, as we shall see, and I will put the basic structure that I've had on the board the last 2 weeks on the board one more time. Well, I'll have it on the board next week too, but so we've got a prologue, and as I'll argue when we get to that, that only goes up to verse 5. Then we have something I'm calling the testimony begins. And of course, there's nothing magical about these names. I'm just using them to refer to the sections. 1:6 to 51, so chapter 1 there. And then we've got a long section. This is not to scale. Prologue, testimony begins, and that's parallel by testimony here. And we've got seven signs. And what we've been talking, what we talked about last week and we'll talk about this week, is the identity of those seven signs. And next week, Lord willing, we'll move on to how this and this is parallel, and then how this is tied in, the whole thing ties together, which hopefully will allow us to see that we've arrived at least one structural element that John put in there, not just that someone else outlined his text that way. So, one of the most significant features of the Gospel of John is the series of signs found in the central section, of which almost everyone agrees we're intended to see seven of them. And though I won't go into all the details we discussed in the previous 2 weeks, John never uses the word translated miracle in the Synoptic Gospels. Instead, he uses the word simeon, normally translated as sign, though it's also rendered as miracle in the King James. He uses a different Greek word than the Synoptic Gospels do. The Synoptics also use the word that John uses, but they never use it to refer to what we normally think of as Jesus' miracles. The emphasis on signs is unique to John among the four Gospels. Of course, what is significant about John's use of this word is that it is a direct and obvious allusion, as one scholar put it, almost an ancient equivalent of a hyperlink. You know, when you're on a website and you see a blue link that says, click here for related information, it doesn't say that, but when you see a blue link and it's underlined, it's like a hyperlink, and it takes you somewhere else, and you go and you see other information. And if you're on some websites, then they pay people a lot of money to make sure you stay on a breadcrumb trail that never ends. But that's a subject for the Book of the Month from last week. Anyways, I digress, and we'll never get done at this rate. So, John's hyperlink had a positive intention, not to make money off of you, but to help you to understand what he was doing in the gospel and how that helps us to understand Jesus. And this language, this sign language in the Gospel of John, is a hyperlink back to the language of the Pentateuch and specifically to the language of the Exodus account. This word simeon is very significant in the Greek translation of the Old Testament Exodus that John would have been familiar with. In the Greek translation of this account, the word John uses for sign is extraordinarily significant, has a huge number of tie-ins to the specific ways in which John uses it in his gospel, connections that the word the synoptics use for miracle do not have. The most prominent of these connections are to the signs of Exodus, signs by which God demonstrated his presence with his people and used to call them to belief in him. All scholars who have studied the Gospel of John recognize the importance of this sign language. This isn't something unique and special. It's one of the most obvious things you see when you start studying John. Yet though most agree that John intends us to see a series of seven signs, and there's general agreement on at least six of these seven, there's been a good deal of debate as to what event in the Gospel of John should be counted as the seventh sign. Nevertheless, I do not think that the identity of the seventh sign is nearly as ambiguous as some have made it out to be. It's my contention that correctly identifying the seventh sign is the key that unlocks the overall structure of the gospel as a whole and will enable us to see the message of that structure. And now, we covered this last week, so I cannot go into as much detail as I did. We looked at all the texts in detail last week, but I'm just going to go over them very quickly as a way of review. So the first sign, and it says it's the first sign, is the changing of water into wine, chapter 2, verses 1 to 11. It's explicitly described as a sign by the narrator, and it's numbered. There's no parallel of any kind in the Synoptic Gospels, and there seems to be an allusion, which the contextual features of context we discussed last week lead me to believe is intentional to the first of the 10 plagues. So Moses turned the Nile River into blood, Jesus turned the water into wine. There's something else going on there we'll come back to. Private. Though the event was more or less public and everyone knew that there was wine, no one knew where it came from except the disciples who had witnessed it. And it explicitly says in the text, the disciples knew, the servants knew, the governor of the feast did not know. This is very significant for the structure of the gospel, and we'll return to it, but not tonight. The sign is specifically connected in the text to the belief of the disciples, so the disciples believed on Jesus because of this sign. And so what we have at the beginning of chapter 2 is the first of Jesus' signs, a sign that was witnessed by the disciples and led to belief on, or more literally, in Jesus. Sign 2, the healing of the royal official's son, explicitly described and numbered as a sign by the narrator. After this, the signs are no longer numbered. We've been given all the clue we need that we're supposed to be counting them. There is a somewhat similar story in the Synoptics to the healing of the nobleman's son, but it's somewhat debatable whether it's actually the same event. It's public in nature. The disciples were present, but everyone who was there, including the nobleman and his servants, knew that a healing had taken place. It was healing at a distance. It was a remarkable miracle. As with the first sign, the second is explicitly connected to belief. So the first sign, the disciples believe, and the second sign, the nobleman and his household believes in Jesus. The third sign, the healing of the lame man by the pool. It's specifically labeled as a sign in subsequent discussion by the narrator. There's no parallel of any kind in the synoptics. It's public in nature. A man who'd been sick without healing for 38 years is healed, and everyone, by the end of the story, knows that Jesus has healed this man. So it's not something that just the disciples knew about. It's something that everyone knew about. Though the sign did not lead to belief, the entire remainder on the part of the man who was healed or on the part of the religious leadership, the entire remainder of chapter 5, as Brother Nate reminded us about on Sunday night, is a monologue by Jesus that's described as an answer to the Jews' reaction to the performing of the sign, a monologue that is focused on the theme of belief, directly connecting the doing of the sign to the issue of belief. And so you have sign language and belief language tied together once again. The fourth sign is the feeding of the multitude, chapter 6, verses 1 through 15. It's labeled as a sign in the immediate context by the narrator and throughout the discussion. The feeding of the 5,000 is one of the very few stories at all that's recorded in all four Gospels. You have the feeding of the 5,000. And interestingly, when you consider the things we discussed about sign language in general, this sign is specifically linked to Moses in the following discourse. There are so many connections to the Pentateuch in chapter 6 of John that it almost makes your head spin. It's impossible to keep track of all of them. And it's about a miracle as you could get. If you have 5,000 men plus women and children that are fed, you hardly, need a select group of witnesses for that because, everybody ate. They all knew what had taken place. They all got this free meal. It's specifically tied to belief in the dialogue that follows. Jesus said, you ate the food, but you didn't get what was taking place, and hence you didn't believe. So they didn't believe, but it should have led to their belief. Sign 5, healing of a man born blind. Specifically referred to as a sign in subsequent discussion by Jesus' opponents. So they refer to it as a sign. But in the discussion that follows, it's specifically referred to as a sign. No parallel in the Synoptic Gospels. Once again, very public miracle. And the significance of this is something we'll get to next week. Everyone had seen the blind man, and everyone could see that he could now see. Once again, the sign's explicitly connected to belief, and in this case, leads to belief. The blind man believes on Jesus, the man who was blind, when he says, who are you, Lord? Who is the Son of Man that I should believe on him? And he believes on Jesus. Healing of someone who had been born blind. And there seems to be an intended intensification of the signs, parallel in a way to the intensification of the signs and wonders in the Exodus account. Once again, the intense selectivity of the Gospel of John comes to the fore. John has picked only the most notable of Jesus' signs, and he has selected them in an order of increasing intensity. There's something else going on there. Sign 6, of course, is the raising of Lazarus, specifically referred to as a sign, both in 11:47 and by Jesus' opponents, and then by the narrator in 12:18. Again, no parallel in the Synoptic Gospels, and once again, a very public miracle. There was no doubt at all that Lazarus had been dead or that he was alive again. And once again, the sign is explicitly and repeatedly connected with belief, both in the discussion that leads up to the sign and in the discussion that follows. Raising of someone who'd been dead for 4 days. So when you have the blind man, he says, since the world began, it hasn't been heard that someone who had been born blind would be healed. So he's drawing attention to the fact that this is really a remarkable miracle. And certainly, if the healing of a man who'd been blind since birth was a remarkable miracle, the raising of someone who'd been dead for 4 days was even more remarkable. There's a progression going on, not necessarily from 1 to 2 to 2 to 3, but if you look at the overall scope from 1 to 6, certainly the raising of Lazarus, more remarkable, we would say, than the changing of water into wine. Summary. Each of these 6 signs are explicitly referred to either by the narrator or by a character in the story in the immediate context using sign language. That is crucial. 1 of the 6 is clearly paralleled in the synoptics, the feeding of the 5,000. 1 is possibly paralleled. The other 4 are unique to John. All 6 are explicitly connected either in the description of the sign itself or in a subsequent monologue or dialogue with belief. In other words, wherever you find sign language in the Gospel of John, you find belief language, and the two of them are interlocked like this. So when you find a sign, it's talking about belief. The two go hand in hand. The first of these signs was witnessed only by the disciples and the servants who drew the water, and the next five were about as public as you could get. In fact, almost increasingly so. There also seems to be, though this is less certain, an intensification in the signs as the book progresses, and I already mentioned this. So, the seventh sign. With this review of the first six signs in place, we can now continue the discussion of the seventh sign that I began last week, but unfortunately, I had to rush through far too quickly, and there was a lot that we skipped over. Using the common criteria for the six signs that are widely agreed on, so those six signs that we just skimmed through, they're not debated. If every list that I've ever looked at of the seven signs of John includes all of those. But using the criteria that we identified, these are things that these six have in common that should help us to correctly identify what the seventh sign is supposed to be. So, all of the agreed-upon signs were specifically described in their immediate context using sign language. So, all the ones that are agreed upon are called signs in the text of John. If we're intended to see seven signs, if that's intended by the author, it would stand to reason there should only be one other identifiable event that's described in the narrative of the gospel using sign language. That's what you'd expect. And as it turns out, there is only one event that meets that description. All the other signs, so the six that we covered, serve the explicit purpose of revealing God's presence with his people in the person of his son, calling on those present to believe, regardless of whether such belief was actually forthcoming. Whatever the seventh sign is, one would expect it to fulfill the same purpose. So with the first six, we saw sign language and belief language locked together and referring to the same event. If we're going to identify the seventh sign, we should expect to see the same thing. As it turns out, that's exactly what we do see. One would furthermore expect that the seventh sign, at whatever point in the narrative we find it, would fit with what seems to be an overall pattern of increasing intensity and symbolic significance. As it turns out, the seventh sign does exactly that, and in a remarkable way. None of the other candidates for the identity of the seventh sign fulfill even one of these criteria. So there's one that fulfills all of them, and not one other that fulfills any of them. So, we'll list some suggestions. The great catch of fish in chapter 21. Though this was certainly something we'd classify as a miracle, it's not described using sign language by either the narrator or anyone else in the story, nor is there any mention of belief. So in chapter 21 of John, there's no talk of a sign, and there's no talk of belief. In fact, in striking contrast to the end of chapter 20, it's referred to, this catch of fish, as among the things Jesus did, not to the many other signs that he did. In other words, John goes out of his way to not describe this as a sign or to give any implication that it could be or should be seen as a sign. Furthermore, if there is anything to the increasing intensity of the other signs, this would surely have to be anticlimactic for all but the most devoted of fishermen. Another one that has been suggested is the walking on water in chapter 6. This is not described or referred to as a sign, even though we would classify it as miraculous. If you could walk on water without some technological device, we'd say that's a miracle. But John doesn't call it a sign. And furthermore, in John's gospel, he does not connect it to belief. There's a discussion of belief that follows, but it's with the crowds who saw the sign of the feeding of the 5,000. There's no further development of the story of walking on water. The cleansing of the temple. Now, the cleansing of the temple is the most plausible in John chapter 2, verse 13 through 22. Now, this is the most plausible candidate of those that have been suggested, because there is sign language in the general vicinity. Yet, verses 18 through 22, which I'm going to go ahead and read, so if you want to turn in your Bibles to John chapter 2, and we'll read verses 18 through 22, which is the what follows the cleansing of the temple. It says this, "Then answered the Jews and said unto him, What sign showest thou unto us, seeing that thou doest these things? Jesus answered, and said unto them, Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up. Then said the Jews, 46 years was this temple in building, and wilt thou rear it up in 3 days? But he spake of the temple of his body. When therefore he was risen from the dead, his disciples remembered that he had said this unto them, and they believed the scripture and the word which Jesus had said. So in this passage that we read, we have sign language and belief language tied together. But this does not, when you read it carefully, does not refer back to the non-miraculous cleansing of the temple, but it refers forward. It's an advance preview of something that at this point in the narrative of John has not taken place yet. So the signs or miracles of verse 23, so if you read verse 23, now when he was in Jerusalem at the Passover, in the feast day, many believed in his name when they saw the miracles. It's the same word translated sign, which he did. That's not referring to the cleansing of the temple. That's referring to what John talks about at the end of chapter 20. There are many miracles that Jesus did that he didn't record. So what if John is intending us to identify seven signs, then it needs to be seven things that take place in the narrative of John, not things that don't take place in the narrative of John, that John says, these happened, but I didn't record them, if that makes sense. So, and the belief language in this passage is connected not to the cleansing of the temple, but to the resurrection. By this point, I am sure that many of you, even if you were not here the past 2 weeks, have deduced what I think is almost certainly the seventh sign. There is, in fact, only one event, or rather combination of events, in the Gospel of John that is specifically referred to as a sign more than once, and we'll get to that, clearly has a revelatory purpose that is intended to lead to belief and fits into the overall pattern of increasing intensity and significance to the series of signs we find in John's gospel. That event is the crucifixion, resurrection, ascension of Jesus. What Jesus referred to in deliberately enigmatic language as glorification or lifting up, words that themselves form a fascinating Old Testament allusion that unfortunately we don't have time to explore tonight, but you might want to look at Isaiah 52:13. Before we can explore the details of these assertions or the significance of all of this for the structure of the Gospel of John as a whole, I need to spend at least a little bit of time explaining why in the Gospel of John these three events should be seen as so closely linked together as to be properly seen as a single event, a single sign. I need, in other words, to explain the hyphens that I put on the board. Now, as I mentioned before, one of the characteristic features of the Gospel of John is to take a word that's either relatively uncommon in the Synoptic Gospels or is not commonly used in the Synoptic Gospels with a symbolic or significant meaning. So it's just an ordinary part of language in the Synoptic Gospels, and John will take that word and either use that uncommon word a whole lot or use a not significant word in a very significant way. That is one of the primary features of the way that John writes his gospel. And he'll invest certain very otherwise common words with enormous symbolic significance and use them over and over and over and over again. He only does that with a few words, but with just about everything that he does deal with, that's how he deals with it. Whereas the Synoptic Gospels give brief summaries of many of the things that Jesus did and said, John has chosen to select just a few of those doings and sayings and present them in much greater detail, often drawing out very different, though not contradictory, emphasis than those found in the Synoptic Gospels. In our previous discussion, which we only briefly reviewed tonight, we saw that process at work with the life language that is so pervasive in John's Gospel. A similar process is at work in John's use of the word hour to describe the complex of events that together forms the seventh sign. If you search the Synoptic Gospels for the word hour, you will find that it actually occurs relatively frequently. Yet what is significant is that if you read the context in which the word occurs, you'll find that when they do use this word, the Greek word is ora, that's what I was searching for, they generally are using it in a perfectly ordinary, non-symbolic sense. So in our ordinary communication, if you need to refer to a particular sort of time, you would say this hour, the sixth hour, the eighth hour. You can't really have you know, a lot of kinds of conversations without using the word for hour, right? Because it's just part of the language, like the word for month. You may use the word for month symbolically for something else, I don't know, but we still find it necessary to refer to months and days and those sorts of things in our ordinary language. And that's the way the Synoptic Gospels use it in all but one place. There's only one passage common to all three Synoptics in which the word hour is used in a way that seems to me to have symbolic significance. Though, as we'll see, the particular significance it is given in the Synoptics has a rather different emphasis than it does in John, and looking at the different emphasis that the Synoptics give to their one symbolic use of this word hour, and the emphasis that John gives to his many symbolic uses of the word hour, will help us to see why, when we're talking about the signs in John, it is appropriate to use hyphens to talk about the crucifixion, resurrection, and somewhat more debatably, the ascension. So I will read the sole place in the Synoptic Gospels where the word appears with what seems to me to be a symbolic significance. And the way I determined this was by reading all the verses in which it appeared and determining that. So you may come to a different determination. And if so, let me know and I'll reconsider. Mark 14, I'll just read them. We won't look them all up for the sake of time. But Mark 14, 35, and he went forward a little and fell on the ground and prayed that, if it were possible, the hour might pass from him. And then the one that's actually more parallel to the other Synoptic Gospels, and he cometh a third time and saith unto them, sleep on now and take your rest. It is enough. The hour is come. Behold, the Son of Man is betrayed into the hand of sinners. Matthew 26, 45, then cometh he to his disciples and saith unto them, sleep on now and take your rest. Behold, the hour is at hand, and the Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. And Luke 22, 53. When I was in Jesus, in this particular, it's still the passage of the Garden of Gethsemane, but in this context, Jesus is addressing those that are arresting him, and he says, when I was daily with you in the temple, ye stretched forth no hands against me, but this is your hour and the power of darkness. So it's clearly being used in a rather similar way in all three context is the same basic passage, basic pericope in all three of the Synoptic Gospels where this sole symbolic use occurs. All these references are, of course, found in the Synoptic account of the arrest and the prayer in the Garden of Gethsemane. The hour in these passages is quite clearly focused on the crucifixion, on the hour of darkness as contrasted with the glory that is to follow. In the Synoptic Gospels generally, particularly in Mark, the emphasis in the account of the crucifixion is on the contrast between the shame of the cross and the glory of the resurrection. In fact, this is a contrast that pervades Mark's gospel. Jesus wants to go the way of the cross, and the disciples want an easier path. You find that over and over again in the Gospel of Mark. And you find that Jesus says in Mark chapter 8, verse 31, and he began to teach them, the Son of Man must suffer many things, be rejected of the elders and of the chief priests and scribes and be killed, and after 3 days rise again. So you have in the emphasis that Mark gives, you have a first the cross, then the resurrection. And that is really something that pervades Mark's gospel, though we don't have time to explore all of that tonight. Though I can't go into this in detail now, one of the concerns of the Gospel of Mark in particular, and this is something that's also found in Matthew and Luke, though to a lesser extent, is to draw a contrast between the desire of Jesus' disciples, both then and now, it's not something that's gone away, to skip the cross on the way to glory and the way of Jesus, which always leads through the cross. And the use of the word hour in the Gospel of Mark reflects this contrast. So when Mark uses the word hour in that one passage where he uses it significantly, he uses it to make a contrast between the crucifixion and the resurrection. This emphasis, and it is a matter of emphasis, not a contradiction, is not found in John's gospel. John's use of the word hour, as we will see, emphasizes the unity of the crucifixion, resurrection, ascension. It emphasizes the paradoxical glory that was already present at the cross itself. This is likely at least one of the reasons why John, for instance, does not recount the Garden of Gethsemane at all. He doesn't recount Jesus' anguished prayer in the Garden of Gethsemane. Instead, he has taken the one time the Synoptics use the word hour with symbolic significance as a jumping-off point and has used it all throughout his gospel investing it with enormous symbolic significance along the way. Now, having seen the one significant use of, and I put significant in quote marks, not that the other uses are insignificant, but they're not being used in a symbolic sort of way, of this word in the synoptics, let's take a quick look at some of the more important passages, and for the sake of time, we'll have to be selective because John uses it many times. John chapter 2 and verse 4, not coincidentally, during the first of Jesus' signs, Jesus says to his mother, Jesus saith unto her, Woman, what have I to do with thee? Mine hour is not yet come. Clearly, Jesus is using that not just to speak of the time of day. Mine hour is not yet come. In John 4 and 5, there's extensive, though slightly different use of our language. So we've got sign language, we've got belief language, we've got our language. Anyways, hopefully that does not get too annoying. John 7 and verse 30, then they sought to take him, but no man laid hands on him because his hour was not yet come. John 8:20. These words spake Jesus in the treasury as he taught in the temple, and no man laid hands on him, for his hour was not yet come. Clearly, there's something in John. He's using this theme of Jesus' hour and he's using that throughout the gospel. John 12 in verse 23, Jesus answered them saying, the hour is come that the Son of Man should be glorified. 12:27, now is my soul troubled, and what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour, but for this cause came I unto this hour. That's the closest parallel that John has to the synoptic gospels in the Garden of Gethsemane. Chapter 13 and verse 1, now before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour was come, that he should depart out of this world unto the Father. Let me just read that one more time. When Jesus knew that his hour, same language, his hour was come, that he should depart out of this world unto the Father, having loved his own which were in the world, he loved them unto the end. John 17 and verse 1 is the last one we'll read. These words spake Jesus and lift up his eyes to heaven and said, Father, the hour is come. Glorify thy Son, that thy Son also may glorify thee. Now, the point I've been getting to with this somewhat long-winded discussion about our language is this. John uses this language not only as in 12:27 and the verses that follow that to refer to the lifting up of the crucifixion, but also to refer at one and the same time to the glory that followed, including not only the resurrection, but even the ascension. The hour is the hour at which Christ goes to the Father, right? So when John uses this hour language, he's tying all three of those events together and viewing them as one. So he's taking what are three separate events and viewing them and putting them together as one event because, of course, they're both connected and you can look at things together, you can look at them separately, and you see different things when you do that. So, in other words, John takes language that the synoptics use to draw attention to the contrast between the cross and the resurrection and reworks that language to draw attention to their unity. Our need to see both sides of the coin is one of the reasons why God has given us more than one gospel. So both perspectives are true. There both is an important distinction between the cross and the resurrection, and there also is a tremendous unity between the cross, resurrection, and ascension, and we need to see both, which is why God has given us gospels that present both perspectives, because both are important. And of course, we can never see any event perfectly, that's a whole other lecture, so I will not get on that or I'll never stop. What we need to come away with from this is that the seventh sign in John includes not only the resurrection, but also the crucifixion. And the significance of this, why I've made such a point of this, is something we'll actually come back to next week, Lord willing. Now, having made this somewhat extended journey through the hour language of the synoptics and the Gospel of John, in order to explain, at least in outline, why three events we usually think of as distinct should be seen for John's purposes in his gospel as united, let's return to the passage in chapter 2, sometimes used to argue for the cleansing of the temple as the seventh sign. I'll read verses 8-22 over again. Then answered the Jews and said unto him, What sign showest thou unto us, seeing that thou doest these things? Jesus answered and said unto them, Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up. Then said the Jews, 46 years was this temple in building, and wilt thou rear it up in 3 days? But he spake of the temple of his body. When therefore he was risen from the dead, his disciples remembered that he had said this unto them, and they believed the scripture and the word which Jesus had said. If you read this carefully, and I mentioned some of this before, it is the coming death and resurrection of Christ that's actually referred to as a sign, not the cleansing of the temple itself. It's important that the sign consists of the two events together, not either of them separately. So the sign is, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I'll raise it up. The two are connected. That is what the sign is. This is the only event recorded in the pages of the gospel that is specifically referred to as a sign that's not already been counted as one of the six. So there's no other event in the Gospel of John other than the crucifixion resurrection that is described as a sign and not already counted. Yet this is not the only time that this event is described as a sign. If you turn to John chapter 20, verses 30 through 31. And many other signs truly did Jesus in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book, but these are written that ye might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing ye might have life through his name. Here is one of the points at which John makes it clear just how selective he has been. Jesus did many signs, not just the 7 that John records. Yet what is significant about this is that it comes just after John has described the resurrection. So in chapter 20, you get John's account of the resurrection, and John doesn't give an explicit account of the ascension. What John does is he has Jesus tell Mary, I'm ascending to the Father, to my God and to your God, go tell the disciples about this. So that's what John doesn't present the ascension after the fact. He says the ascension is coming, and both of those are in chapter 20. And after John has finished his description of the crucifixion, resurrection, and foretelling the ascension, then we have, and Jesus did many other signs besides the sign that was just described, concluding with this chapter. And let's see. John is specifically describing what he had just recorded as itself a sign in striking contrast to what he does at the end of chapter 21, in 21 verse 25. And there are also many other things which Jesus did. So it's not like John just uses sign language accidentally. He's very intentional in his use of language. And if he says he did many other signs, then it means he's talking about a sign that he just did. If he didn't mean that, he wouldn't use that language. Belief language. Furthermore, so our kind of keys to the signs that we found in all of the 6 signs, we had sign language. Always, if it's talking about one of the signs, it's using sign language. It also always talks explicitly about belief. Well, if you go back to chapter 2, and we'll be thumbing between the two of these a little bit here, in verse 22, when therefore he was risen from the dead, his disciples remembered that he had said this unto them, and they believed the scripture and the word which Jesus had said. And chapter 20 and verse 31, but these are written that ye may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing ye might have life through his name. So this sign is explicitly tied to belief language, just as we would expect from our survey of the first 6 signs. The sneak preview of chapter 2 we just read, this sign is said to lead to the belief of the disciples. And the concluding summary we just looked at, the signs that have been recorded are tied into what almost everyone regards as the purpose statement of the book, the belief of those who read and hear John's gospel. Furthermore, not only is this sign, as we would expect, referred to explicitly as a sign. So it's explicitly referred to using sign language, and it's the only event other than the 6 that everyone agrees on that is so described. It's specifically tied to belief. Both every time it's referred to, it's tied to belief. It also, and at a number of levels, it's the climactic sign, as we would expect from the signs, the way the signs are tracking with the Exodus account. There's no doubt that this sign is the sign to which all the others have been pointing. And I don't think I need to spend a lot of time arguing that of anything that happens in the Gospel of John, the crucifixion, resurrection, ascension is the most significant. I think that doesn't need to be argued for. As the hour itself, the hour to which all the other signs led up to, it was the ultimate way in which God demonstrated his presence with his people and called them to belief. And I'm not going to belabor this obvious point anymore, but there's something a little bit less obvious. As I mentioned earlier, John's use of sign language, so this whole matter of he's using this word simeon, it means sign, the whole reason he's doing that is to tie back to the Exodus account. That's not the only tie back to the Exodus account. Not surprisingly, not only does this seventh sign have the greatest intrinsic significance, it also has the strongest connection of any of the signs and the most explicit connection back to the book of Exodus. Also, not coincidentally, the first sign is connected to the first plague and the seventh sign is connected to the tenth plague. That's also not an accident. In the recording of this sign, we find not simply an allusion, but rather a direct quotation of the account of the final plague of Egypt, just as the first sign had alluded to the first. So we'll turn to John chapter 19 and verse 33. John chapter 19 and verse 33. But when they came to Jesus and saw that he was dead already, they brake not his legs. But one of the soldiers with a spear pierced his side, and forthwith came there out blood and water. And he that saw it bare record, and his record is true. And he knoweth that he saith true, that ye might believe. We're going to come back to verse 35 next week. For these things were done, that the scripture should be fulfilled, a bone of him shall not be broken. That's a quotation from Exodus chapter 12. Moses had turned water into blood. Jesus turned it into wine. Moses gave them temporary bread. Jesus gave them the true bread from heaven. That's in chapter 6. Moses had ordered the sacrifice of the first Passover lamb. Jesus provided himself as the final Passover lamb, the lamb that God had said all the way back in Genesis 22 that he would provide, which, by the way, is the only lamb in the entire Hebrew Bible that God ever said he would provide. So there's only one place in the whole Hebrew Bible where God is said to provide a lamb. That's in Genesis chapter 22. Here is Jesus being provided. And that passage in Genesis chapter 22, by a connection to another passage in Isaiah 53, is actually being interpreted by John the Baptist when he says, "Behold the Lamb that takes away the sin of the world," and he ties this verse to this verse to this verse and links it all together. And when you realize what he's done, which I can't keep in my head and I didn't write it in my notes, it's absolutely bewildering. But when you see it, you can't unsee it. And John is explicitly tying that back to the Lamb that God is going to provide. And here is the Lamb that God has provided, and it's the Passover Lamb. And there's a lot of other connections to the Passover here as well. But the point that I want you to see is that we started, the signs were connected to the signs in Egypt. The first had a connection, the last had a connection. There's also some connections along the way. Furthermore, while the other signs, but it's climactic in another way as well, while the other signs were described as such by the narrator, or even in one instance by Jesus' opponents, this final sign is introduced by Jesus himself when he offers a cryptic description of his death and resurrection in response to the demand of his enemies for a sign. So they said, "Give us a sign." And this is what Jesus said his sign was going to be. That in itself is a climactic way of introducing it. In other words, while all the other signs are identified as such by the narrator or even by one of Jesus' opponents, the seventh sign is identified in advance by Jesus himself. In conclusion, then, the death, resurrection, ascension of Jesus is the only recorded event in the gospel, other than the six signs that everyone agrees on, that is explicitly identified as a sign. It is explicitly connected to belief language, and it clearly serves as a climax, not only to the series of signs, but also to the series of references to the Exodus account that all of John's use of sign language is ultimately pointing back to. Now, there is one aspect of this seventh sign that we have not yet discussed, and that is something it has in common with the first of the seven signs, something it shares with none of the others. It is that something, which we will, Lord willing, cover next week, that helps to unlock for us the structure of the gospel as a whole and address the dilemma with which we began our series. I'd encourage you to try to figure out that connection for yourself.